cigarettes and the ghetto's play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true will always love you, no matter what you do.
It's the light, the light, the light, the light, the light. It's the light, the light, the light. It's the light, the light, the light, your light, your light. It's the light, your light. Spitfire Breeze, the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices.
Is now 6:05 p.m.
We have an exciting program in store tonight. Poetry, music, news, and some highly enlightened political commentary on subjects ranging from the revolutionary loneliness, media backlashes on race, and the inequities of the Canadian immigration policy.
We are also happy to welcome Bethany Orr to the studio today for an interview on her experiences co-creating a new documentary called Being Chinese in Quebec. Welcome, Bethany.
Woo! Thank you.
So stay tuned to Spitfire Radio.
It seems like within Quebec society, there is never a moment where we as inhabitants are debating our rights, whether it is culture, religion, language, or race. But of course, this is all a matter of opinion based on what side of the Fleur de Lis you find yourself on. And this is what I'm here to talk to you about. For some, there is no issue when it comes to any of the above-mentioned subjects. If you live in Quebec, you are expected to abide by and respect the foundational values that have established and shaped this province. No debate, no questions asked. For it is a question of having national pride in where you live, and to speak out against its values is seemed almost as blasphemous. If you have ever chosen to live here, it is almost that there is the expectation that you must agree with every political decision made or have a shared opinion like that of your fellow inhabitant. Because if you're not with Quebec, you're against it. You threaten the very core of what it means to be a quote-unquote Québécois. Take, for instance, the matters of the many kirpan, head coverings, language and racial debates that have happened over the last couple of months. To what end do people's individual rights have to be disrespected in order to live comfortably in this province without fear of an attack, silencing, or ostracization? Can we not embrace our own beliefs and that of where we live without having to compromise one or the other? Is that detrimental to the way we live and our interactions with others if we put our beliefs before that of the masses? It would seem so. But it is also a matter of who decides to be that rebel. I would like to point out two vastly different stories with similar issues dealing with Quebec's handling of language laws and racism. Although both can be seen as somewhat political in nature, the way that the wider audience received them is somewhat baffling to me. One was the story of Megan Moran, who worked at an IGA grocery store in the South Shore, who came out to speak against the language discrimination she faced at work as an Anglophone. Although she was bilingual, she was not permitted to speak English to a co-worker on her break because it was believed that, and I quote a statement by the store owner, Louise Menard, if we permit languages other than French to be spoken, what will happen in the employee's room? We'll have a ghetto. We'll have a small group of Spanish, a small group of English. The other story was that of Nydia Dauphin, who spoke out against the prevalence of blackface within Quebec entertainment in her articles and the racism that it promotes in Quebec. Now, what is baffling is that both voiced their issues publicly through different means of media. Moran through CTV, Dauphin through Huffington Post. Yet Moran accumulated support and positive media attention, as far as I know, while Dauphin faced ridicule, accusations of being a racist herself. And not only that, she was never approached to hear her side. To paraphrase what she said in her article, in a piece by Judith Luzier that was published by the Journal de Montréal Metro entitled All Quebecers Are Racist, I am accused of, amongst other fallacies, calling all Quebecers racist. Somehow, by sharing my thoughts and experiences as a Quebecer, I cease to be one myself. Placed by this media outlet as a spiteful outsider to the only society, culture, and civic family I have intimately known. By sharing my thoughts and experiences as a Quebecer, I cease to be one myself. Oh, sorry, I already said that. This makes me wonder why both articles experience such different reactions from Quebec society. Both women are from here, both are educated, both are Anglophones, speaking out against injustices they have faced as fellow Quebecers. Yet one is given a safe outlet to voice her opinion while the other is silenced. Is it because Moran was a young white female and Dauphin is a black woman? Is it because of the media outlet each chose to do? Or is it simply a matter of racial tolerance for who is speaking out against certain injustices they face in Quebec? The stories of Moran and Dauphin questioned the ability of Quebec society to have an open platform for Anglophones to have a voice, especially when it comes to Anglophones who are also women of color, as we see in the case of Dauphin. It seems that when we do speak out against issues, we are typecasted into certain roles while also having our messages morphed and interpreted into something it is not. Where is our right and Dauphin's to have the global support that Moran did? Where is our opportunity to have our voices heard, and what will it take for this society to actually listen? It brings us back to the mantra of the show in terms of saying no to the silencing of our voices. For we will be heard, and it will be a force to be reckoned with.
Yay!
On my shoulders, pressure to break or retreat at every turn, facing the fear that the truth had discovered, no telling how all this will work out, but I've come too far. Thank you.
much, Mercedes. That was an incredible editorial. I love what you said at the end, for we will be heard and it will be a force to be reckoned with.
You're very welcome.
I appreciate it. Okay, so we have a little quote from Stephen Harper here. You won't recognize Canada when I get through with it. Sadly, this is one instance where Stephen Harper actually told the truth. Canada is rapidly changing, particularly when it comes to its once-lauded immigration policy. Hear now more on these changes. A Pakistani grandmother recovering from a heart attack was arrested at a Montreal hospital by border officials and told she would be deported from Canada the next day. Although Khurshid Begum Awan's removal on Wednesday was eventually cancelled following protest by her cardiologist, refugee advocates criticized the Canada Border Services Agency for its actions. There is no reason for this kind of belligerent and intimidating tactic, said Rosalind Wong of Solidarity Across Borders, who was the woman at the Montreal General Hospital when the arrest occurred, Tuesday. Three officers just showed up at the emergency room and informed her she was under arrest. It's really disturbing. We call on healthcare providers and administrators to ensure people accessing health services are safe from border agents. Although officials wouldn't comment about the specifics of the case, a spokeswoman for Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney said, a key part of the CBSA's mandate is to remove those who violate Canada's immigration laws as soon as possible. Everyone ordered removed from Canada is entitled to due process before the law, Julie Carmichael added. All removal orders are subject to various levels of appeal. Awan, 57, and her husband Mohammed Khalil, 66, arrived in Canada in 2011 and sought asylum, claiming their lives were at risk due to violence by the extremist anti-Shia group, Sabah al-Sabaha, and now banned in Pakistan. The couple's refugee claim, federal court appeal, and pre-removal risk assessment have subsequently been denied. Awan's husband was deported in April, while her removal was postponed due to her chronic heart condition. Awan was admitted to the hospital on July 4th and diagnosed with a heart attack. Upon her release 8 days later, border officials visited her on July 18th and 22nd to summon her to the CBSA office to discuss her deportation. Wong said she accompanied Awan to the meeting Tuesday morning, and the woman again reported heart attack symptoms. Wong said a cardiologist at the hospital warned a heart attack victim should not fly for at least 6 weeks, but border officials insisted on arresting Awan and said they would take her to the Laval Detention Center and remove her Wednesday evening. Awan's lawyer, Stuart Istifani, said religious minorities in Pakistan, particularly the Shia, have become targets of unprecedented levels of violence from extremists and criminals alike. He says his client's husband is in hiding after suffering a gunshot on May 7th, shortly after his deportation to Pakistan. Istifani said the official's insensitivity is just incredible and has filed a complaint to Blaney's office, but his client still faces imminent deportation. Miss Awan's case is just one of many. According to the CBSA, over 18,000 people were removed from Canada in 2012, up from 16,500 in 2011. On any given day, an average of 400 to 500 people are detained in Canada for making the courageous choice to migrate. Countless individuals and families, including children, have been torn apart from their communities and locked up in detention centers under conditions that are fundamentally inhumane and degrading. And with new legislation, the numbers will only increase. From 2006 to 2011, more than 83,000 migrants were detained by Immigration Canada, with an additional 13,000 since 2011 alone. Immigrants can be detained for indefinite periods of time, with no idea when they will be released. In Quebec, the Laval Immigration Holding Center is the largest detention center in the country, with an average of 100 people confined within its walls daily. Aside from the three designated immigration detention facilities, migrants are also currently held in 43 provincial prisons across the country, including Rivière-des-Prairies Detention Center in Montreal. With the privatization of detention, private companies like Corbet Management, BP Hamilton, and Garda Security, which runs the Laval Detention Center, are just three of many who are reaping millions of dollars from the criminalization of migration. Annually, Canada spends $92 million on detention and the removal of human beings, with more than $22 million of that for public safety anti-terrorism. This at a time when Canada is closing its doors to migrants, supposedly for the sake of the economy. Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Immigration Minister Jason Kenney are underhandedly taking apart the so-called objective points-based system. They are moving quickly to get rid of its humanitarian part, the refugee process. In its place, they are setting up temporary work programs that are designed to push most migrants into vulnerable, precarious, and temporary jobs without access to services or the ability to unionize. Today, the only means to apply for permanent residency from outside the country is through a spouse. That, too, is not open to all, as certain applicants will only get temporary residency for their first 2 years. In 2008, for the first time, over 300,000 people entered the workforce on an exploitive temporary work program. Today, there are over 480,000 people entering the country as temporary workers without access to the most basic benefits. Migrant workers can now legally be paid 5 to 15% below the average wage. At the same time, there are over 500,000 undocumented people without access to good jobs, healthcare, education, childcare, housing, shelter, justice, or dignity living in Canada. Under Bill C-50 and C-56, among others, immigration minister and officers can arbitrarily decide who can come into Canada and who cannot. The Family Reunification Program has been modified to actually deter reunification. Currently, there's a moratorium on parents and grandparents getting a visa. Temporary migrants are also permanently temporary. Many can stay up to 4 years in Canada without having to leave to renew their work permit, but are unable to apply for permanent residency. At the end of the 4 years, they're forced to leave and cannot return on any visa for another 4 years. Refugee acceptance rates have been cut each year and halved in the last two decades. As of November 1, 2012, 68% of refugee applicants had been denied in the fiscal year. The Conservative government passed wide-ranging changes to refugee laws, which allowed the government to designate certain countries as safe. Applicants from countries deemed safe will face an expedited process with only 60 days to prepare their case and only 40 days to find and file evidence. Also, instead of a relatively impartial board member deciding claims, claims will be decided by a civil servant. Application forms recounting one's life conditions have been removed and replaced with an informational interview conducted by a civil servant 10 days after they make their claim. The new rules also make it so that a person losing their refugee claim is ineligible for either a temporary resident permit application or a pre-removal risk assessment application until a year after they lose their claim, while enforcement will be mandated to remove them within this year. The new rules also take out all questions of risk from the humanitarian and compassionate application. For years, immigrants' rights groups have called for an establishment of a refugee appeal division, as one was created under the Liberals but never implemented. The carrot of such an appeals division was used to convince many organizations to support changes to the refugee policy. The appeal system is a paper application void of any real appeal hearing, while other egregious portions of this bill, including $500 million in immigration enforcement, have been implemented. In 2008 and 2009, the United Nations set a goal of 560,000 resettled refugees in OECD countries. Of these, Canada accepted about 11,000, most of whom were applications from inside the country. At the same time, the UNHCR announced that Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan accepted 885,000 Iraqi refugees between them. The latest attack is Bill C-31. Bill C-31 gives the minister the power to single out for special punishment refugees who are suspected of having fled their country by means of smugglers. These punishments are harsh and inhumane. Asylum seekers suspected of using a smuggler will be subject to mandatory detention for the first year after their arrival, with no chance of review, including for children. They also will not have the right to appeal a negative refugee decision. In addition, they'll be prohibited from obtaining permanent residency for a period of 5 years after obtaining refugee status. This means these refugees will be held in limbo, not allowed to leave the country nor sponsor their family members, effectively separating them from their families for a period well beyond those 5 years. At the same time, even more refugees will now be denied health care. Canada champions itself as a beacon of progressive immigration and settlement policy as it moves toward a temporary immigration system. Yet the reality is that migrants of color earn 40% less than their white counterparts. In major Canadian cities like Toronto, the number of immigrants who are poor has grown by 125% over the past 20 years, and almost 60% of poor families are from racialized groups. Immigrant neighborhoods are underserved and marginalized. Immigrant families have little access to recognition of credentials attained in their home countries, good jobs, or to services such as affordable childcare. Many immigrants sacrifice themselves and their aspirations for the betterment of their children. Despite these sacrifices, second and third generation immigrants remain in exploitive jobs, are pushed out of schools and universities, are targeted by the police, and are unable to fully access opportunities promised. Even more than immigrants with full status, temporary migrant workers and people without any documents face exploitive and precarious work and living conditions. In December 2009, four migrant workers fell to their deaths in Toronto working in unsafe conditions. In September 2010, two migrant workers died while working at an apple processing facility. Migrant workers are not allowed to bring their families and are forced to be alienated in the new communities they contribute to. In the last few years, immigration enforcement has carried numerous U.S.-style workplace raids, arresting hundreds at a time and forcibly deporting them without due process. The enforcement arm of immigration targets non-status people that it considers most vulnerable. Women at shelters, people at community gardens, people in hospitals. These tactics push already vulnerable, undocumented people into situations where they face greater risk and exploitation. People are being targeted at work, sometimes after their IDs are arbitrarily checked on the streets or when their doors are kicked in at night. Families, including children, are held in detention centers for months, even years, and deported without access to the lives they built or contact with their friends and relatives. And now they're entering the intensive care units of hospitals. These are the facts. As of December 15, 2012, immigrant communities face mandatory detention, denial of access to justice, denial of permanent residency, and a discriminatory two-tier system. In the face of this onslaught, a dramatically new way of imagining migration is required. A full and comprehensive regularization policy that would give full immigration status to all undocumented people, accompanied by the ability to gain full status on arrival for migrant workers, is a first step. These changes must be accompanied by the cessation of wars, development projects, and corporate interventions in countries around the world that create many of the conditions of displacement in the first place. But even as we petition the government, we must fight within our own communities for regularization from the ground up. We need to push immigration enforcement out of our cities and ensure that all social services, health benefits, and welfare wages are available to all people, irrespective of immigration status. What we need is a solidarity city. If this is a fight you're interested in being a part of, consider joining Solidarity Across Borders on Sunday, August 11th for a family-friendly rally and picnic in front of the Laval Immigration Holding Center to denounce the unjust and racist detention of immigrants and refugees. For more information, please visit www.solidarityacrossborders.org.
Thank you, Malek, for that very insightful and eye-opening piece, and thank you for putting it out there. And now we have a poem by Spitfire Collective member. Read by Collective member Preeti Dhaliwal.
Self-help for fellow refugees. If your name suggests a country where bells might have been used for entertainment, or to announce the entrances and exits of the seasons, or the birthdays of gods and demons, it's probably best to dress in plain clothes when you arrive in the United States and try not to talk too loud. If you happen to have watched armed men beat and drag your father out the front door of your house and into the back of an idling truck before your mother jerked you from the threshold and buried your face in her skirt folds, try not to judge your mother too harshly. Don't ask her what she thought she was doing, turning a child's eyes away from history and toward that place all human aching starts. And if you meet someone in your adopted country and think you see in the other's face an open sky, some promise of a new beginning, it probably means you're standing too far. Or if you think you read in the other, as in a book whose first and last pages are missing, the story of your own birthplace, a country twice erased, once by fire, once by forgetfulness, it probably means you're standing too close. In any case, try not to let another carry the burden of your own nostalgia or hope. And if you're one of those whose left side of the face doesn't match the right, it might be a clue that looking the other way was a habit your predecessors found useful for survival. Don't lament not being beautiful. Get used to seeing while not seeing. Get busy remembering while forgetting, dying to live while not wanting to go on. Very likely your ancestors decorated their bells of every shape and size with elaborate calendars and diagrams of distant star systems, but with no maps for scattered descendants. And I bet you can't say what language your father spoke when he shouted to your mother from the back of the truck, "Let the boy see!" Maybe it wasn't the language you used at home. Maybe it was a forbidden language, or maybe there was too much screaming and weeping and the noise of guns in the streets. It doesn't matter. What matters is this. The kingdom of heaven is good, but heaven on earth is better. Thinking is good, but living is better. Alone in your favorite chair with a book you enjoy is fine, but spooning is even better.
Thank you, Preeti, for that reading of Self-Help for Fellow Refugees by Lee Young Lee.
Miss a day at school, and he's on. don't stay deliberately. Yeah, but they can fuck around and push delete. Two of my girls on prescription pill. I know how you feel. Two of my boys in Iraqi field. This ain't no time to kill. Two of my girls in therapy. See, I'ma tell you this for free. Two of my folks up on the hill. With the cake and the dollar bill. You need to watch the dirty cop. They the one you need to watch. I'm talking about the dirty cop. They the one you need to watch. Stop. You get the wake up call. It's on the building's fault. A boat crash with the final call. Get your money, dollar bill, y'all. Both crash with the final call. Get your money, dollar bill, y'all. To my folks on the picket line. Don't stop till you change their mind. Got love for my phone. Baptized when the levee broke. We gon' keep marching on until you hear that freedom song. And if you think about turning back, I got the shotgun on your back. And if you think about turning back, I got the shotgun on your back. Back. What am I talking about? Everybody know what the song's about. They be trying to hide the history, but they know who we are. Do you want to see everybody rise to the next degree? Raise your hands high if you agree. Just say.
Welcome back to Spitfire, only on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's 6:35 this beautiful Wednesday evening. This is Victoria Nam on the microphone. We're just rocking out to some Erykah Badu in the studio here with Malak and Mercedes as per usual. Being Chinese in Quebec is kind of a sequel to Malcolm Guy and William Ging-Wee Deer's earlier documentary film, Moving the Mountain, which aimed to uncover the unjust history of early Chinese Canadians. Wed to this past, the film introduces a new project of inquiry. What does it mean to be Chinese in Quebec today? In order to carry out this investigation, it seems that the filmmakers followed two Chinese Quebecers on a road trip around Quebec, meeting a unique and diverse cast of quote-unquote Chinese Quebecers, or peeps who identify in one way or another as Chinese but are also living in Quebec and who may or may not identify as Quebecois or some hyphenated derivative. So just to give you an idea, they meet a DEP owner with two PhDs and say to Agapit, a second-generation activist lawyer in Quebec City, a chiropractor, politician, new immigrants, fourth-generation suburbanites, drag cleaners, all who have something to say about being Chinese and Quebec. And today, we are super lucky to have none other than one of the road-tripping investigators and main character in the film, Bethany Orr.
Whoa, what an intro.
Yeah, you like that?
I love this welcome.
You're probably like, when is she going to stop talking?
No, you did a good job of summarizing it.
Right, so Bethany Orr, you were one of the main characters in this film. Along with Parker Ma, you went around Quebec interviewing interesting people. Do you want to tell me how you got involved in this amazing project?
Sure. Well, where do you want me to start? Started in my childhood. Well, I've always thought about questions of identity. And I think particularly because I was born in Hong Kong, but then we moved when I was one. And so I've often had this, you know, persistent question of what would my life have been if we'd stayed in Hong Kong and I was a full, you know, full-on Hong Konger Chinese. And I think, like a lot of, I identify more as second gen than first gen, but I think like a lot of second gen kids, I really, you know, oscillated between feeling really confident in my identity and then ashamed, and some forms of internalized racism as I was growing up. And all this time, I really didn't know much about my family's history. And it was actually when I got to Trent University, which is a really wonderful place to get politicized, as I did, I started to learn more about things like the Chinese head tax and the Exclusion Act, and I kind of put two and two together because I knew that my great-grandfather had arrived in the 1920s in Montreal, and finally I realized, wait a second, my family went through all that crazy stuff, and we did pay the head tax and then lived through decades of family separation, meaning that we lived through this dark history. And so
right.
And then when Malcolm, Guy, and William Jingmi Dear approached me to help out in the pre-production of the film, originally I was actually just asked to facilitate some group discussions with young Montrealers, everyone from Young Chinese Professional Association to a Chinese church youth group. And that initially was just my way of pitching in for the film. And later they approached both Parker and I to see if we wanted to be the main characters. And both of us were kind of resistant at first because, A, neither of us is born in Quebec, even though I have lots of roots here. And B, we just weren't sure what the project would mean. But we were assured by the team that we would have a big say in the direction of the film. And since we'd worked on similar projects, but really quite grassroots projects before with no money, when they said, you know, this is a full production, we thought, okay, let's bite the bullet. Also, Walter Tom, the lawyer that you mentioned in your intro, came up to me one time. He said, Bethany, I have high hopes for you. Since you've arrived in Quebec 10 years ago, I said, you know, this girl's going to be such a great addition to the Chinese community and get, you know, fight for equality and fight against injustice. So after he kind of, you know, not guilt-tripped, but kind of like strongly encouraged me to speak out, then I sort of gathered up my courage. Sorry, I realize that's a really long answer. I guess there's not an easy way to
talk about this. Well, stuff. That's such an interesting story. Like, I thought you were going to say, oh, I bumped into the filmmakers at a coffee shop. But nope. In fact, you had this other position, and then it turned into a project that was, like, all about you guys road tripping around Quebec, which is, and you guys being, like, kind of the, I don't know, like the interesting, you know, human lens in which we are able to, you know, understand all these encounters that you have. I want to go deeper into like the film's themes. Like if anyone who's seen the film, like it begins with this kind of like hardcore captioning talking about, you know, the history you alluded to, that like the early Chinese Canadian history where you know, communities, Chinese community were, you know, kind of amazing in terms of contributing to building the society through working on the railroad and doing all this like amazing labor, but then at the same time we're like terribly treated by the state. The Exclusion Act, which you mentioned, where essentially families were separated and no Chinese immigrants were allowed into Canada, like in 1923, and then also you were saying like the head tax, where, you know, back in the day, like the government put like this very specific tax on Chinese immigrants where they had to pay like an inexorable amount of money, like what, $100?
It started at $50 and then they raised it all the way up to $500, which in those days was enough to buy, I've heard quotes of it, it was enough to buy two houses in those days. So it's really like, and I always call it, you know, the one very clear example of a racist policy that Canada's had, because it was specifically targeted to Chinese and no other ethnic group. And I think there are many instances of Canada being exclusionary in its policy, but this was clearly, to me, clearly racist, which I tell all my students. I teach Sejep, and I make sure that they know that. But yeah, so as you said, in 1923, they realized that Chinese were continuing to come, and what would happen is that the entire village would pool their savings into this one person, and that person would come to Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto. And in 1923, because of there was a very strong pro-white immigration policy at that time. It was called the white-only policy. And in 1923, they decided, okay, that's it. We're not going to allow any Chinese to come in, no matter how much you want to pay. And so in my family's case and in Parker's case, that led to husbands being separated from wives and also from their children, and led to this bizarre situation of eventually in 1947, they repealed the Exclusion Act, partly because the Chinese had gone to fight in the Second World War mm-hmm. and claimed citizenship rights, which they had been denied earlier. And, you know, since they'd given up, you know, they risked their lives for the country, you'd think that
yeah, exactly,
they'd be given the right to vote, for example. And so in the early 50s, a lot of families started to be reunited. But the problem was that these families hadn't really known each other. And this was the case, for example, of my grandfather, who only got to know his father in the 50s. And then he labored for another 10 years before he'd bring over my grandmother and my mom and my uncle. So, and if you can, this I think also happens in the Filipino community, where you end up with these families who don't really know one another.
Right.
And that lack of knowing how to be a family is transmitted down to generations. I'd argue, I think my parents aren't listening, so I'm not too embarrassed to say this, but I'd argue that that lasts for several generations.
For sure.
Not knowing how to be a parent, not knowing what family means. And so even though, you know, it's been decades now since the Exclusion Act was removed, I think that the legacy of these policies can still be felt within our families.
Right, definitely. Generational trauma. It's so painful. And it comes in a lot of different ways, not just with family separation history. Yeah, it's really interesting. The film opens with this question, like, what are the stakes involved of other Chinese Quebecers being connected with this history, knowing their heritage, knowing about this amazing history or not? But then the film also sort of like totally just like, abandons that question.
Well, okay, let me tell you, originally the focus of the film was gonna be what do these generations of Chinese Quebecers think and believe about our history here, and what relevance does it have to being someone who identifies as Chinese today? But then we did these focus groups and no one knew about it because it isn't taught in the school system. And I think that in Quebec there's not enough emphasis on alternative histories, and mm-hmm. so there's a lot of things lacking in the curriculum. And so we couldn't make that movie because no one had, you know, there's kids there whose their families have been affected by it, and they look at us with question marks in their eyes. So we
right.
had to abandon that original focus because yeah. it would have been a really short movie.
But it's like, it's related to other issues that come up in the film.
For
and
sure.
I feel like one of the strengths and weaknesses of the film is the fact that it brings up so many different issues,
yeah,
right?
It's partly, that's the community, right? There isn't one Chinese community. And I always laugh when these census figures come out and talk about how many Chinese language speakers there are. There is not one Chinese language. There's so many. And so that's part of the dilemma of the film, as you point out, is that we can't, you know, neatly package up Chinese Quebecers because there's so many different, and there's like class differences, linguistic differences, cultural differences. So if I meet someone from Dalian in northern China, I have basically no cultural similarities or linguistic similarities with them. So even though we may appear, because we're both, you know, racialized in the same way, we may appear to an outsider as similar, we're actually very dissimilar.
Yeah, it's interesting, this concept of being Chinese in Quebec, right? You actually kind of really focus on that. What does it mean to be Chinese in Quebec? Or what does it mean to be a Chinese Quebecer, or like, how do people identify? Do they identify as Chinese? Do they identify as Chinese Quebecer or Chinese Quebecois or
just Quebecois.
Quebecois or Quebecois of Chinese origin? Like, what do you think the political stakes are in this kind of identity politics?
It's a really good question. And as someone who grew up outside of Quebec, I actually grew up in Ottawa. And I find that secondary or hyphenated or any sort of identities not singularly Quebecois, as Mercedes was pointing at it in her piece earlier, I find that they're pretty actively discouraged. And that might be my take on Quebec policy. But I find this also in my students, because I teach at the Cégep level, I teach humanities, and I teach a course on inequality and ethnic diversity. And I find that there's a real resistance to affirming any other identities other than Quebecois, maybe Anglophone, Francophone, but that young people here are pressured to assimilate towards Francophone culture. And so, you know, I fully understand and support the movements that led to Francophones being able to assert their place in Quebec, which was an injustice that went on way too long. At the same time, I find it very dangerous to have a model in which only those who speak a certain level of French or speak French with the right kind of accent can be included, because then it excludes families like mine who were never able to learn French because they worked in garment factories, restaurants, cafeterias, still work in cafeterias and restaurants. And I find that it's a very, for lack of a better word, it's a very privileged way of thinking about identity to assume that, because the conversations I have with people when I explain this point of view, which is not popular here, I'm starting to realize, is that, oh,
don't worry, we got your back.
Thank you. But, there's always time to learn French. And I think that's such a middle-class privileged way of thinking about it. Because if you, for example, my uncle works as a waiter, he's been working as a waiter since he was a teenager, he works 70 hours a week. There's no way. And so I am strongly against any definitions of identity that don't manage to include all people, because the way I see it going, and I'm definitely not much of a fan of Pauline Marois as premier, and also her statements before when it comes to the communities, it's difficult for me to imagine her proposals being equitable. Put it bluntly, I guess.
There is just like one comment. Like, there was this lawyer that you, an activist lawyer that
Mei
you interviewed,
Mei Chi.
She was really awesome. You asked her, like, how does she identify, you know, and coming from like a family who, you know, mother went mad, you know, like just family suffered so much, worked all the time, and like, you know, couldn't speak a word of French and really suffered from the isolation of not being able to communicate. But then when you asked her, like, what is it, you know, how do you identify? She says, you know, Quebecois, but because it sort of like grants her and she's like claiming her rights and freedoms as a citizen.
Totally.
So Quebecois is not about like, you know, knowing the handshake or knowing the accent or the comedies that are on TV Francais. Yeah. I don't know. I don't watch TV, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really good observation. She also identifies as sovereigntist, which is not common at all in the Chinese community. And and I think that in the end, identity is something that's constructed. It's always, you know, in relation to how others perceive you, but then you can take a more empowered path and call it what you want, which is, I think, what Mei has done, despite what the government might say. Mm-hmm. You know, she speaks French with a little accent, and she may not be familiar with pop culture, but I think that her and others in the film who managed to call themselves Quebecois led to me also finally saying, yeah, I am Quebecois, whatever. I am. My family's been in Quebec for 100 years. I think I can start calling myself Quebecois now. And to take that term for myself too.
Well, thank you so much for coming into the studio today. It's been a real pleasure. I really recommend that everyone go check out that
fantastic film.
Thank you.
How can we see it? How can our listeners take a sneak peek?
We're planning on a couple of viewings in the fall. I guess the best way to keep in touch is to go to our website, which is etrechinoisauquebec.net. Should I spell it out? Maybe you guys can put it on your Twitter feed or something. And we also have a Facebook page.
Okay, sweet. That's awesome. Thanks so much, Bethany.
Thank you.
Thank you. Right, here's a little food for thought from a woman of color's perspective on the Zimmerman verdict that has happened.
I think two weekends ago.
Yep. And that's been
ridiculous.
A topic of interest hot in the media.
Hot topic.
An outrage.
Seriously hot topic. So, what do you ladies think?
Well, this is my one thought that I've kind of been telling everyone is George Zimmerman, had all these ideas that he was, you know, a local cop, and it had come out that he had taken criminology courses, and he was the local watchman, and they called 911 like he was calling a friend. And I mean, for me, when that verdict came out, not guilty, what I thought was, well, George, you always wanted to be a police officer, and you're a real cop now, because we all know the police shoot and kill black men with impunity every single day. So welcome to the club.
Victoria.
Well, I guess I'll just bring up something that Alyssa pointed out, that in the wake of the Zimmerman verdict, calls are growing for the release of Marissa Alexander, the African-American mother of three who was sentenced to 20 years in prison for firing what she maintains was a warning shot at her abusive husband. So we reported on Marissa Alexander's story last year when she was prosecuted by Angela Corey, who also oversaw the case against George Zimmerman. And Alexander insisted she was defending herself when she fired a shot into the wall near her husband and attempted to use Florida's Stand Your Ground law in her defense. But in March 2012, the jury convicted her after only 12 minutes of deliberation.
Ridiculous. That's so who gets to stand their ground in this society? Basically.
Yeah.
Who has any ground to stand on?
Nobody. Well, I guess that's our wrap-up of our Food for Thought, Women of Color Perspective for this show.
But we have a ton more. We're just running out of time tonight.
We'll definitely continue talking about this. We have a really exciting piece from Alyssa coming up next month, so be sure to tune in next month to hear that. You are listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio only on CKUT 90.3 FM. That does bring us to the end of the show. Thank you so much to our contributors, guests, Bethany, check out that film, as well as the many others who make this show possible.
Spitfire Women of Color Radio broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM.
You can write to us at spitfire@ckut.ca and check out www.spitfire.blogspot.com.
Peace, y'all.
Nothing gain, nothing tried. Very few even try. Most just wanna get high from the cradle to the grave. Don't wanna be your slave, and I'm not gonna take it how you wanna. Love me or hate me, support me or snake me. Either way, I show love. Let it make me or break me. I'm the queen of self-esteem. Don't sweat the cream, just set the scene. Get screamed like how you mean. Straight up. On a string, like them hoes sucking on your thing. Overworked and underpaid for days. Behave, I'm not gonna be your slave.